Hey! Welcome. It's Rack Addicts After Hours time, once more, this time from sofas, and it's episode 78. Welcome, and thank you for tuning in. You've got Pete, and you've got Ben today. My name's Ben. Pete's over there. Two whole people, don't get too confused. You'll be fine. We're feeling pretty synthy, actually, today. I had a little peek into the studio. I've seen the moth in person, and there's quite a shiny-looking black row growing down there. It's looking great. But we'll come back to that. Because it's weekly update time first. Actually, Pete, I think we'll come back to you, because we can segue nicely into the synthy bits. I have been doing things for once. Amazing. I was in the Lake District. Oh, it was amazing. Just a family holiday that's been cancelled a million times for obvious reasons. But I got there. I had my portable recorder on me. So I've been planning a bit of a sample pack for the wonderful Patreon supporters of the Modular Cafe of the ambient stuff. The method I used when I was a Euro racking, I had the Music Thing modular chord organ first. Did I have the chord? Yeah, I had the chord organ first, but I then realised the Radio Music was a much better proposition. So I had just an SD card full of rain that I'd recorded, stuck a microphone out my window, got some storms in there, recorded some of my sister's dramatic prose. Some of those were fun to stick through the Bafaco crush delay. Those were some of my favourites. Either way, lots of babbling brooks, rain, weather. So I've got some better stuff now in stereo, which we'll come back to, the stereo issue. But yes, there's a lot of that, lots of babbling brooks. It was nice. But this time I also had the geophone from Loam Audio, which I think I might have mentioned some podcasts back. So I was at the bottom of Skelwith Force, quite a dramatic waterfall in the lakes, with the H5. So I had my stereo, just mics built in. But then I also stuck the geophone in the ground and got the rumbly, which is pretty cool. So I'm going to be mixing those together, offering a little pack for our Patreon supporters. It should be pretty cool. I'm pleased with the stuff we got. A few clanging gates. I didn't bother with any sheep noises because, you know, that's a bit obvious, that one. But that'll be nice. The other thing, there was coffee involved. And Pete, we're going to be talking about cases, modular cases, but let's also talk flight cases because you're a bit of a flight case aficionado. Have I told you about my flight case plans?
No, do far away.
So if you're a Tested fan, you will probably have come across Adam Savage going on about how much he just loves cases for things. I do like a case for a thing. And I have vague plans, which might have to be put into motion vaguely soon, for a Pelican case purely to make the coffee setup transportable for holidays. So that fancy grinder, the Niche Zero, can come along with the manual espresso machine and the filter coffee stuff with a handy space for the beans. Extra. It's a bit excessive.
So is that just UK holidays, or do you intend to take it internationally?
I'm not going to take it out on planes or anything, but it was brilliant. I've probably mentioned before that, I don't know if I've mentioned before, but I pursued an education in music production, which prior to being education was just a hobby. I started playing guitar. I thought, ooh, you know what, let's record some of this. And I sort of went down that rabbit hole. Great hobby. And then I thought, ooh, hello, there's an A-level for music technology. That sounds great. Let's do it at university. Big mistake. What I discovered was, if you have a hobby, at least for me anyway, you have a hobby and you try and sort of go education, you think, oh, so this will be my career. For me, it didn't turn out well, just because the joy of the hobby was ruined by the career or the work, the obligation to pursue it. Much like working in a certain music store has somewhat dampened and completely removed my enthusiasm for music sometimes. So I don't want a coffee shop job, but making coffees for the family for a week was brilliant. They put in their orders. My mum and my sister are big fans of the cappuccino, and I actually, surprisingly, I managed to convert my dad to the espresso tonic, which is unexpected because he's never been an iced coffee man. And this is a bunch of ice cubes, espresso, lime wedge, and tonic water. And it's surprisingly, it's incredible. It does make a weird foam, but that's really great. I've ranted a bit, but at some point, I might be wandering around on holiday with a huge Pelican case full of coffee supplies and, you know, a tiny little bag with, you know, clothes or something. But that'll be fun.
You've got to look after the important stuff.
Yeah, obviously. The most important stuff is the expensive coffee grinder. Enough about my recent escapades. What have you been up to, Peterino?
Well, the ongoing gas saga continues.
It grows.
It grows. The acid rain chainsaw turned up today.
Yes, I heard it briefly earlier. It's, yeah, it's great. It's 4 really, HP, isn't it? And it's...
Yes, and it's really lush. A really well-built module. Sounds quality as soon as you get it plugged in. And I haven't really sort of integrated it with ADSR or a VCA.
Or even the stereo filtering yet.
Nothing yet. So it's just, that was just the pure output from it. Plenty of possibilities there.
It does sound great. I was just thinking, you know, what else is there from Acid Rain technology? Because that's a brilliant one. What might they be cooking up? Nothing that exciting at the moment. But hopefully they've got a couple of cool.
They've got about 3 modules, I want to say.
We have 5 on modular grid.
Oh, a bit more than that.
One of which is just a 3U to 1U adaptery turn on its side style. They've then got Switchblade, which is a 3-channel switch and no control mixer. And then they've got Maestro, which is a clocked modulation controller. So sort of sequential switchy matrix mixer combo majig. And then they've got Navigator, which is a fader based attenuator, attenuverter and mixer.
I believe you used to be able to, or may still can get it as a kit. So you can build that one.
Yes. No, you're right. That I'm pretty sure that's on Thonk still.
So it looks like it might be quite a useful thing if you wanted a sliding attenuator rather than a knob.
Yeah. And it's got quite a big throw, so you can have hands on fine control. You know, sometimes if you're trying to do that on a tiny trim pot, that I know that.
You're not
that's
sure
no good.
If it's actually turning, do you?
Totally. Yeah, that's not a fun time. So yeah, chainsaw. It's good. It's great. I saw Belgrad and Batumi, and they look great with the black panels, actually.
Yep. And what else is in there? There's Mimeophone.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a radio music with a black face.
Oh, yes. And of course, stochastic inspiration generator.
Yes, with the expander.
Mm-hmm.
I've got the hex mix, but that's still in surgery.
Surgery,
channel
yeah.
Channel 3 is still...
Still weird. What was the issue with it again?
Channel 3 seems to sort of... You know how that you've got the momentum switch?
Yeah, yeah.
I think is it up where it's fully positive? It's actually engaged fully, and then down it's just like a momentary flick.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's in the middle position, it should be off, but I'm getting sort of bleed while it's in the middle position, the LED's on, and when you flick it either way, it just sounds rough. It's just on one channel 3.
Yeah.
And I've taken it apart, I've sort of resoldered the components, and I fear that I might have to get a second kit and build it, and hopefully this one will work. Then I can split the, because it's a 2 circuit board kit, and then I could cross exchange the boards and work out exactly which circuit board is the problem, and then that might help me locate and drill down to exactly what the problem, because I really must sort it out.
Yeah.
And I can't really afford to end up with 2 hex mixes, one not working properly, because once I've got 2 working versions of it, one will get sold, so I can recoup some of the finances.
We're currently embroiled in the boring back end of organizing an event, you know, the risk assessments and stuff, so you've got time for the outdoor modcaf thing.
Yes, I'm going to be ready when I'm ready.
Yeah.
And it still feels, with this shockingly bad weather, the weather goes from one extreme to the other. So at the moment in the UK, the weather is pretty awful considering it's midsummer.
Mm.
Or technically it's midsummer. I mean, it's almost like, it's almost autumnal.
Yeah,
or maybe early spring to the tail end of winter. It's just not, I mean, yesterday was the longest day.
Oh, what was it?
June the 21st. The solstice was
a bit of a letdown.
Well, about 100 people turned up at Stonehenge for the solstice.
I saw that. Yeah.
Defied the National Trust, who look after it, and climbed over the fence, sort of did their thing. But yes, Joe, so yesterday, the longest day, midsummer, and I was freezing. It was cold. I just couldn't get warm properly. It was horrible.
I had been, you know, watering my bonsai twice a day because it was so hot and dry, but I haven't for the last few because it's been raining.
And hence, I still feel that there's weeks and months to go before any live outdoor thing, because it still feels like summer hasn't arrived.
Yeah, I mean, we had download in some form that happened
this last weekend, wasn't it?
Yeah,
and that was one of the government's test
trials.
I think it was only 10,000, normally 100,000 there.
Yeah,
so wasn't that Nebworth Park?
I believe so, the normal site. Are you a festival person normally?
Not especially. I mean, I have on occasions. We used to go to Glastonbury back in the day, but we're talking in the 80s. That was the last time I went to Glastonbury. But in more recent years, I went to Stonehenge, I want to say in 2017, for the solstice. Venice.
Yeah.
And there was a good 10,000 people there.
Really?
Wow.
And they had proper security and the whole place was ring-fenced by police. And obviously they were being very cautious and searching everybody and checking everything. But once you were in there, people were just all over the stones and doing their thing. Lots of no PAs or musical equipment allowed, but a lot of people were just making do with sort of percussive bits and bobs. A few people had sort of very small personal type bits and pieces.
Yeah.
It's mostly to sort of just spend the night with a sort of group of people and sort of welcome in, and there was an interesting sunrise.
Yeah.
I actually took a reasonable camera setup and we went round interviewing a few of the druids.
Oh, cool.
Who appear. So that was quite different. And obviously at that type of event, there's some quite strange people, if you put it politely.
Yes, of course. What's the political BBC way? They were happy or were they quite tired? Is that what they say on TV?
Possibly. Eccentric.
One of those. Let's jump into some news because there's only a couple of bits that we want to chomp on. We couldn't talk about it, though we knew about it quite a while ago, actually. Berenger Breins has been announced, leaked, whatever. This is, I'm not even going to put it politically or anything, it's just a rip of Braids or whatever. What is the current mutable sort of multi-oscillator thing? I can't even remember. What kind of a modular man am I?
You know, the last year or so, or maybe a bit longer, there's certain things have been dropped from the line and new modules have come forth.
It is Platts, which was the one after Braids. So Platts, and there's also Beads, Blades, you know, the kind of thing. So Behringer have called it Brains. And I think they've also gone a little bit of let's poke some fun at Korg or something with their naming of certain bits. They call it the multi-engine oscillator, which, given the oscilloscope and the Korg affiliations, that's a little bit something there. But no, it's got the same model and mode rows, and it's got basically the same CV inputs and that kind of situation. It's saying it will do, it's going to do, you know, wave-shaped stuff. It'll do wavetables, bass, snare, hi-hat, vocal stuff, chords, physical modelling, so you know what it's doing. It is bigger. It's 16 HP, but of course, 150, 160 euros, 150 quid. That's potentially tempting for some people. If, like many, you're just allergic to Behringer, then you're safe, don't worry. But
it's a lot of functionality and for not a lot of money.
If you're comparing to the mutable, because mutable's been great value anyway, you're sacrificing potentially build quality, potentially ethics, I don't really know, but I'll leave that up to you, and just kind of space.
So are we thinking that they have grabbed the code?
When it's in, I'm sure somebody is going to grab it. When it's in somebody's hands, I'm sure we'll hear about it if it is, but it's...
Because it's open source, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I wouldn't put it past them to think that's and handy, we'll
perfectly,
have that.
They're perfectly within their rights to do so, though it's not nice. The trouble that Arturia got into with the Micro Freak was stating that it was designed in collaboration
when it wasn't.
With Mutable, when it was had nothing to do with it. It was just they grabbed the stuff.
What did they actually get in trouble, or was it just a few sort of
I don't know that there was any
thrown around.
I don't think there was any legal trouble, but you know, the social medias and the forums kind of kicked off and things. People got at Archery about it and they took down those particular bits of copy from the website.
That's fair enough.
Yeah.
But other than that, there's not a lot that can be done.
Yeah. But we'll see. It's not arriving for a good while, but we'll let you know when we know.
What's your estimate, November?
It wasn't even on the ordering systems when we were at work last, so I'll
making
be optimistic. September.
Okay, because they really were making a lot of noise about it.
Yes, many noises. So we'll see. I'm personally in trouble / intrigued. I mean, it's looking good. It does also have a USB thing on it, so I don't actually know off the top of my head what that does. Is that, can you do MIDI control off that? What's the thing? Is it just for firmware stuff? I don't know. USB Type-B on the front, which obviously isn't the most space efficient connector, but there we go. And that's basically it. That's the news that we've got to work with, but we've got lots of stuff to chat about.
Well, I've got a confession.
What have you done?
It's not what I've done, it's what I've not done, to be honest.
Well, lay it on me. What's happened?
Well, although actually owning a Make Noise Maths for a good 5 years, possibly longer, I've only just worked out how to use it properly.
Well, I mean, it's a deep module. I mean, how bad are we talking? What have you not known that it...
Practically everything, because I watched quite a number of sort of tutorial videos about it, but I got the wrong end of the stick completely. Ah. So every time I went to use it, I wasn't very successful.
Okay.
Just sort of didn't bother and just ignored it. I bought it initially because everybody's rack had one in it, and everyone was saying you've got to have a mass. So
at modular shops, they say you've got to have it.
You've got to have it.
And I resisted. I built a Bafaco Rampage and wish I'd bought a mass.
And every sort of video about it says that you've got to have one, and there's a, and it's consistently one of the top modules.
Yep.
And I really hadn't. There was a particular, I can't remember which YouTube channel it was, but they kind of described it as a four channel mixer in some respects.
Can be.
It kind of is, but it doesn't, I find it, although you can put audio in it, that's where I was going wrong. I was passing stuff through it. If you really want to sort of work with function generators, you've got to use it as a secondary, you know, so almost use it like an LFO.
Well, yeah, you can do sub octave generation with one of these, which is pretty fun. That's a cool trick.
And I was watching, it was a Mylar Melodies video that I was watching yesterday, and he was doing quite a lot of cross patching on itself. So,
oh yeah, good fun.
So sort of had an inkling. I thought, have I fried this? Because it was involved in a kind of reverse polarity incident.
Ah, okay.
My initial case was a 84 HP by 9U Dofer inexpensive case, you know, the plain
the plywood ones,
cane one. The first one was fine, filled up with modules. I need another one. Purchased the second one and promptly puts some modules in, just a few, just to test it, powered it on, and one of my modules went up in smoke.
Actually smoke?
Yes, actually smoke. The case had been wired incorrectly.
I nearly
wrote a stinky letter to Dieter Dofer. And it genuinely been badly wired on one of the strips. I was able to correct that, and the only module that suffered was, I think, one of my Pittsburgh modular ones, which I was able to send the circuit board back to Pittsburgh, who kindly fixed it for free and returned it to me.
Oh, that's great of them.
And it was really only the sort of load resistors that you have right on the voltage pins. So that's all that had gone on that, and they just replaced the resistor.
But your maths was in the case at the time.
Was in the case at the time, but I believe quite a few modules have got
reverse polarity
protection, just in case. Because obviously the one of the pitfalls, especially if you don't have a shroud around the pins on the...
Even if you do, that wouldn't have helped you in that situation, would it?
No, that's because I don't think the Dofer has. It's got naked pins, isn't it?
Yep.
And you have to be careful that you've got the red stripe on your cable.
Yeah, and you can
down.
Even offset it by sort of one notch and then bend a bunch of them if you try and force it in.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the ones I use now with the cases that I build have actually got shrouds and they key in because there's an actual... You can't actually physically turn them round.
Just for peace of mind, that's my preference.
Yes,
as well.
Certainly. Anyway, so there was a suspicion that the mass had sort of taken a hit, so to speak, but it seems to be okay. I had done a diagnostic. There was a make noise video that went over some of the basic functionality, and I did all those examples, and it all seemed to work. But again, as going back to what I was saying earlier, I have not had a great deal of success with it until yesterday.
Oh, nice.
I really thought, this is ridiculous. I really need to learn this. And a lot of it's just pure laziness. And again, it was in another gas period where I was literally buying module after module. So it was just more about getting all the modules from one particular manufacturer as a collection. It was a completist type of thing.
Well, the Pittsburgh row does look great.
And there's still a few things I haven't got and they don't make anymore, but I'm still searching. So I would, if a Crush ever came up, the Pittsburgh modular Crush, that's supposed to be quite good as a bit crusher in itself.
Hold on there. I think I know a guy. Remind me later.
And there's a few other little bits and pieces. They did a quite nice sequencer that was almost like a little 8-bit gaming kind of...
It's called Game System, I think.
Yeah, exactly. There was that, and there was a... Was there a wavetable oscillator they did? Basic one?
Maybe.
I haven't got everything, but I've got a good proportion of what Pittsburgh originally did in their normal plain silver livery, kind of 1950s sci-fi styly, before they did all the new designs and the new livery.
I do like the new look, but there is something classic about the Dymo tape kind of printing letters on the old stuff, and it's just plain and cool.
But then that just went on. Same thing for the Make Noise, same thing for IntelliGel. But you eventually realise that they're just going to keep bringing out modules, and you can't keep chasing that, and you've got to focus. And this current system that I'm building, the black system, is all about choosing exactly the right modules, although they've got to be black. But in most cases, a lot of manufacturers, there is always a black and a silver option, which is nice.
Lots of them, unless you're IntelliGel.
Yeah, but I'm sure if you really wanted a particular piece of IntelliGel, you get a third-party faceplate for it that's black.
Potentially. This just in, I have a message from Akira, who we interviewed a while ago. New addition to the case, Mungo Enterprises, D.O.? I don't know what it is, but I'll have a look and I will reply to your message later. But that, Akira says, not switched it on yet, but I'm already scared. So that's how we go with modular.
So they're getting back into it then?
Yeah, there was a little bit where the joy might have sort of got a bit sapped out by, I think, just creative workflows and things, but still happening. One of the other mod caffers, David, one of our listeners, David, I think he's just jettisoned it all. He did a me. He's still synthing, but I think he's going electronish, a lot of that kind of stuff. But he's got a matriarch, actually.
So he's
now
not going full cold turkey then?
No, not like I pretty much did. Yeah, he's unmodulared. So Kira's like, I don't have anyone to talk modular with. But here we are. We're still going.
Well, I'm sure he'll go back into it at some stage. It seems to be something
we'll tempt him.
I mean,
he's got the matriarch. He's got...
Yes.
Yeah,
that's,
need it.
Yeah, it's a bit like being on and off the wagon, isn't it?
Yep. Well, we'll see how it goes. I have a question for you about cases. Obviously, you had that low-cost Dopefer. What's your case history? Was it just you did that, you got another one, then straight to the moth?
Yes. So I bought one of the low-cost cases, as I stated earlier, and then a second one.
Mm-hmm.
So I had two of those, and then unfortunately, or fortunately, they became full. And then I built the first moth, which was moth one. Which was five rows of 168 HP.
Mm-hmm. Was it 168? Because that's the longest you could get from your supplier.
Well, that was
man.
The size that I went for, and it was. I thought, well, that's two rows of, or each row is 2 times 84, so it all worked. And then moth one got full.
Yeah.
So then I built moth two. I mean, moth one was a bit of a prototype. It was, what do you call that design? The kind of arcing,
that sort of lab equipment vibe that I really like.
Yeah, sort of the kind of arcing curve.
Yeah.
It was my own design, but it followed the sort of...
Yeah, something like the classic Le Monde stuff.
I got the components from a gentleman called Stefan in Berlin. His company is called Clicks and Clocks.
Ah, yes.
And he supplies rails in silver or black and power supplies, and he's just getting into some small utility modules now.
Oh, yeah.
Did try to go to the source and find a good supply of rails in the UK, and I was talking to people who supply that sort of thing for data centers, or for people who make up cabinets for data centers, because obviously Eurorack is a comms data computer equipment standard. And I did find some suppliers, but they were excruciatingly expensive for what it was. And they supplied it in sort of 3 meter lengths and things like that. And I was, how hard is it going to be to cut this stuff really nicely? I mean, obviously, you can hacksaw it, but you want it to be really kind of almost polished at the end. So I came across Stefan, as I say, Clicks and Clocks in Berlin, and purchased the first lot rails and power supplies for moth one. That, and he had a Dopefer, it's almost exact copy, because I think he had been talking to Dieter Dopefer about it, because it looks identical to the original Dopefer power supplies for their nine new cases. I think Dopefer have moved to a switch mode power supply now, rather than this is a big toroidal transformer. Got quite a lot of current, so there's no fear that you're going to put some hulking great module in there, or enough modules in there to, it's got more than enough capacity, let's say, for
like
whatever you want to throw at it.
Strymon Magneto that defeated one of my systems a while ago.
So the Moth 1 had 4 power supplies.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And 10...
Then like bus
rails.
Board things,
Yeah, bus board, bus rails. And then I thought, I need a bigger one. So I purchased the largest rails that he sold, which were 200 HP.
Yeah.
And that is Moth 2, which is the current one. And as I say, Moth 1 was a sort of prototype. It was soft pine. I was sort of experimenting with routers and how to do it. And once I went to build Moth 2, I'd already had the templates, which I kept from Moth 1. So Moth 2 is, apart from being wider, it's identical physically, except I did it in white oak.
Right, yeah. So still, what, is it 5 rows?
5 rows, but 200 HP, which is a funny size. So I've ended up with these sort of 1 HP wide gaps. But now that I know that Erica since do the 3 HP,
the Pico stuff, which is really good actually, I like
I
those.
Think that will solve my gap problem, because I can intercede 3 HP and that will soak up that bit of space, because it's just annoying when you're that finickety that you've built this system. It's in this lovely white oak, all the modules are silver, it's got this uniformity, and then you've got these annoying little 1 HP gaps and you think, I mean, I think I got rid of one because I've got some Harvestman equipment and some of the modules are non-conventional sizes, and that seems to do it, but all the others seem to really stick to their 2, 4, etc. kind of widths. But yeah, I'll sort that out. So the new one, in theory, is going to be another. It's like going to be a mini moth.
Oh, you gonna? Is it going to be arcing, arced, angled the rose?
Possibly not. Maybe just flat, not skiff, because I've got to get the. I've got another one of these power supplies from Stefan.
Oh yeah,
to go in, and I've got a rail, several rail kits to use.
Yeah.
So it's just currently going to be two rows of 84 HP. But then my mind's sort of been wandering and looking
three
at
three rows, three.
Yeah, I know. I need three rows to be really honest. So. I've now started being casting my eye over pre-made cases.
What's on your hit list?
Well, it's difficult because there is so much choice out there.
Yeah. While you're brewing up some of those top choices, I'll quickly run our audience through my case history because there were a few, not too many. I started out, and I have advised many people when I'm at work, don't just start modular. Buy a semi-modular first and then go. I ignored my own advice. I think I buy first? A Turing machine, cord organ, and one of the expanders, which is a weird combination. I had a Tip Top Micro's used power supply. And before I had a case, I just made a weird frame out of Lego Technic pieces, which actually worked surprisingly well. And I kept using that for a bit after I got a Happy Ending kit, the Tip Top 19-inch, got one of those, and then still used the Lego case as kind of overflow. After that, yeah, it was my first sort of proper case, which was a 2U, not 2U, 2-row, 6U, 104 HP from a small brand from Italy, I believe, called Nono Modular. And this is actually a friend had linked me to these ages ago. It's made from kind of resin-infused MDF thing. It had a slight angle on it, briefcase style. Actually, I sewed a little rain jacket for it so I could take it outside, all right. That was a brilliant case, and I'm sad that I no longer have it. After that, because I was taking it out and about a lot, and it was quite heavy just to hold in the hand, I wanted something backpackable, so I ended up with an Eastwick 6U case, which came, well, not came with, but you could get a really great backpack for with lots of pockets, and I used that loads, took that around to ModCafs, I played Wilderness Festival with that. I took that system to North Carolina to play there. That was really good. And then, of course, with the joining plates, I then got a second case and I had my four rows of 104 HP. And that's as big as the modular got before the great jettisoning of a while ago.
You didn't feel like keeping the case. You just had to get rid of all of it.
It all went. But I started just ditching one of the extra case. And then, you know, this is a nice enclosed system, fits in the backpack. That was around the time I had the OPZ and was using that with the key step as kind of a control system, and then it slowly left,
just melted away, it's just gone.
Yeah, I do actually have, well, I went through all my kind of Google Photos library, just ditching all the stuff I didn't care about, and I've made a folder of all the pictures that I kind of needed or wanted of the synth or any kind of synth stuff. And I do have, yeah, I've got a picture in front of me here of the last configuration, which I can run you through, because it was a pretty, at that point it was missing some stuff, but it was kind of an interesting configuration. I tend to put my mixing stuff on the right hand side, sometimes on top and bottom, but I had two IntelliGel mix-ups, the stereo mutable sort of mixers, and also two stereo balanced Bafaco output modules, which is a sort of remnant of when I did that quadraphonic stuff. There's also 2HP Verb and the Pico DSP, which that's one of those 3HP Erica Synths ones for my effects. I have a Zlob Unicursal VCA, that's six VCAs in a box. Manis Eteritas from Noise Engineering. In Micro Ornament and Crime, Batumi with the expander, Bafaco Crush Delay. If you ever want a glitchy, weird delay, that's brilliant. Then some boring MIDI stuff, and the two kind of flagship pieces with the Subharmonicon and Instruo CSL, and also the Digitax. Now it's all gone. Actually, the only thing that I think remains of that setup is the Zoom H5, which was tacked onto the side, and the Genelec speakers that I have in this picture.
And you still have those?
I still have those. They're great. The little 80-20s.
Yeah, I mean, this is not the sort of thing you really want to ditch.
What, Genlex?
Yeah.
Or any of it.
Yeah, what was the motivation? You just felt it had to go.
It was a pretty severe point of that thing we were talking about earlier, the music retail and having no enthusiasm for the stuff. And I'm not using this.
There's every time, like, you looked at it, you just felt guilty.
Yeah, and there's like, you know, three or more grand's worth of stuff just never getting used there. And I couldn't handle that. So it all left. And there's some great pictures here. Like, I had a pretty cool sort of performance system together. This was what I was doing Wilderness Festival with, which was notable differences there would be Euclidean Circles was in this particular version, as well as I had an Instro TSL instead of the CSL, which is the small version. That was when I had radio music and rings, and also the Lollipop compressor, the God's Box module. Yeah. I had Belgrad at that point, as well as Bafaco Rampage. Actually, that was a tidy performance system. So I had that modular. I had the OPZ for my drums and my samples and sequencing stuff. Had the key step just for control and convenience. And I then had a Korg Minilog, the original one, and a Behringer Neutron. See, if I had had the energy to be creative, I could have made some pretty good stuff with that. But I just kind of rinsed the old bits. Oh, well. Nostalgia.
Well, hopefully you'll go back to it.
It's brewing. It is brewing.
Yes, good.
The next pictures down are actually the quadraphonic system, which is pretty fun. The notable changes on this, apart from the doubling of the case size and the Neutron being in the rack, is I borrowed clouds from our friend Nick Cohen for Ambient Fun Times. I had two Wong LRMS MSLR. I think that's what the module is called. That's a mid-side processor, which is kind of cool. And I also borrowed from Ben from the Modcaf the Sputnik quad tap delay. I used that to have, you know, the input, which would then have a single tap of the delay go through each speaker. So I got these little delay spirals. That was really fun.
Wasn't that a lot for your final dissertation?
Yes, it was. There was the dissertation as in the written bit, which was then supported by a practical project. And my practical project was a performance, which was also then sort of distributed as 5.1 surround quad and binaural mixes.
So it all served a productive purpose.
Mm, yeah, and I'm very glad that I went through that modular journey, and I've learnt a lot, so I'm excited for round two.
It's not like you haven't been purchasing. Bought the Lyra 8 relatively recently,
mm-hmm.
and the Plinky.
Yeah, so the Plinky will, that's Eurorack mountable, so that will likely be the first thing in there. It'll probably come back out again because it's great and portable, but just to have something as a sound source while it grows.
Well, this kind of gets us back to the case thing, because I always think that the case for everyone, including myself initially, is the biggest barrier, because it is
a healthy investment, unfortunately.
For something that doesn't actually do anything.
Yeah.
Doesn't make any sound, and it's quite inexpensive. You're paying for this box that may or may not have power in it.
Yeah.
And if you're, you know, you're new to the whole Eurorack thing, it's, you know, which one is the best one to get?
Yeah, the beginning is so difficult because you don't want to have that huge outlay, but at the start you'll have, like we said, big empty box, and you'll probably be starting with cheaper modules that might not accomplish as much. So that starting system is really quite painful, which is why I always say semi-modular first. And a Behringer Neutron's a great place to start, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, I can't really dispute that.
It's one of their good options. That and the DeepMind are top of our collective lists, I think.
Yeah, so I've been looking at commercially built units.
Yes, I'm wondering what your taste is.
Well,
in commercial
the one that
stuff.
Caught my eye, but only because someone was selling one of these in good condition, and it kind of alerted me to this manufacturer that I wasn't familiar with, and isn't that available? I mean, it's available, but it's not in all retailers.
Yeah, yeah.
Put it that way. So it's the Emerton Sansan.
S-A-N-S-A-N?
Yes.
Have a look. Oh, yeah, there it is. Oh, yeah, so on Signal Sounds, 400-ish quid. Oh, hello.
Yes. And
that
they
does
really,
look tidy.
They really go on about how good the power is, how clean the power is.
Yeah, that looks... It looks like a... looks a bit like an IntelliGel case, but without the 1U row and a
Except
little
it's also
sleeker.
Got a lid as well.
Yeah.
It does have a 4 mono channel type of outlet.
Do they make their own?
And they make a
cart.
They make a module for that.
Yeah.
But I don't know how useful that would be, especially if you're using a performance mixer.
Of course, yeah, might already have that sorted.
So I did consider, there was one on eBay, and it was sub £300. I want to believe for the 84 HP.
Ooh, that is good.
I think they were asking £290 for it. They currently retail in the UK or only at Signal Sound UK. And those ones currently retail for £389.
Yeah.
Because unfortunately, the IntelliGel cases, as nice as they are, they're really expensive.
Yeah, no denying they are pricey. What, 700, 800 quid? Oh, wait, no, 700. Yeah.
That's a lot of money for a tin box.
Yeah. Oh, no, they
or
do.
Or an aluminium box, I should say.
Extruded, how dare you?
Extruded aluminium box. But I suppose it's got power, but that always increases the cost quite dramatically.
Does. And they do have their little adapters, so you can easily kind of glue two of them together to get a 4-row system. well, 4 and then 2 €1 as well, which is pretty neat.
Well, yeah, though you can make a case relatively inexpensively if you've got the wherewithal, you have the tools. And
the metal one's going to be considerably more difficult.
Yes.
And that's good for durability, of course.
I'm not sure. It kind of looked a bit delicate. There was another case I saw that was really nice. It was like a kind of polycarbonate, but it was still quite thin. So it was about, I would say it's about 4 or 5 millimeters thick.
Yeah.
And it was a sort of textured polycarbonate, and it looked strong and robust, but interesting. But again, it was very expensive.
Just had a quick Google on the Sansan. It's not looking great. There's not much review on there. The only one is basically just kind of one guy. Although he's had a good experience with the company, though. But he had some issues with the aluminium being quite thin and the tolerances not doing too well. But it looks like he's been sorted on sort of customer service. He's got a free of charge replacement.
It was an unknown entity, and I found myself not bidding for it. I mean, I could have purchased it outright. It was £290 was the buy now price, but there was make an offer. I sort of thought, do I make an offer? And it just didn't quite sit well. I mean, it looks nice aesthetically, but it was such an unknown entity. I'd never personally come across them before.
Yeah, although 60 odd mil of debt, will you be all right with that, with the stuff you're planning on?
All the stuff I've got is skiff friendly.
Okay.
The new stuff anyway.
Imagine off the top of my head, the radio music is probably the chunkiest one. It's not that deep.
No, but it is quite chunky. The tinsy sort of hangs off the back.
It does, yeah.
A bit.
A little backpack.
So it's difficult to gauge, because it'd be quite nice to have a very flush, low sitting case. I mean, at the moment, my mind's still wandering back to the utilizing the components I've got and making something. But I was thinking, do I go to the extent of making it in oak again and maybe even having dovetail corners and going the whole hog?
Problem is, if you're doing that, it's going to be so heavy and you'll sacrifice the portability, which is kind of the point of this
one,
I suppose.
Yes, exactly. So it's that dichotomy between how portable you want it and or aesthetics and practicality and cost.
Yeah. Always the way.
All those elements. I mean, I have thought about getting these small 4MS pod cases just as a test unit, because they're quite inexpensive.
Good little desktop one. Yeah, I think the top of my list at the moment is actually the biggest Ginkgo Synthese DIY case. It's basically just laser cut MDF. They end up pretty strong just because of the metal supports that keep all the rails in line. That with some of the 4MS row power supplies, which you can daisy chain, which I've had a great experience with. That's looking like the avenue at the moment. And yeah, something like one of the bigger powered 4MS pods would be great, just to take a couple of little somethings around.
I mean, I've been perusing a lot of the suppliers of flight case materials. I was wondering whether it was worth building one using the extruded aluminium and the
So it's just
stucco
sort of
board.
Yeah, and then just rivets and the corner and sort of
I'm sure
angled
it's
bits. And
quite achievable, but unfortunately, even the components aren't as cheap as one might imagine.
Oh, yeah.
What's
the damage on some of those?
Well, the corner pieces weren't that expensive. They maybe, at the extreme, maybe £1 each or a couple of pound each. And then you got the aluminium extrusion. That was slightly more expensive. But it was the laminated board they used for the flight cases. That was very expensive.
Interesting.
For what it is.
Could you just, I mean, is it any fancier than just a nicely coated plywood or something?
I mean, that's what it is. It's a plywood, but it's obviously got the thick laminate.
Yeah, on the outer edge.
On the outer edge to give it that extra bit of protection. That was one avenue, or I thought maybe just build it out of 9mm ply and then wrap it in some sort of vinyl.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a myriad of ways of doing this, but it's choosing which direction you go. You don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole and then decide that it possibly wasn't the right move. Generally, it's things like the rails. They're not essentially that cheap, are they?
No. And then, it's the power supply, because that's supporting your hard-earned investment. You can't cheap out on it.
I do prefer an internal power supply rather than having a
sacrificing space for modules
and having a power brick somewhere floating around. I think that's preferable, to be honest.
That's a good point, actually. I hadn't considered that. I think previously, when I'd thought about making a case, I think Topper Brillo came up quite often as a slightly underground but really well respected power supply, quite expandable as well. Might look into it again.
But when you look at other manufacturers' cases, they're all rather lovely, but they're all pretty expensive. Again, even being a sort of somewhat seasoned modular aficionado, addict, or whatever you want to call it.
Addict's probably the
Addict's the most probably the... it's still very daunting when you think about it. You think...
Yeah, I don't envy people only just researching it and then thinking, okay, so I need a case first and... there's the pricing. One sort of, I guess you'd call them a boutique brand, really. Have you heard of MDLR Case?
Not personally.
Think, don't quote me on this, I think they're from Russia-ish, potentially. No, I'm totally an idiot. The Netherlands. Why did I think Russia? I don't know. But we're talking, well, they do studio and portable cases with power supplies. I think developed their own power supply. So let's have a look at one that's kind of a typical comparable format. Okay, a little bit tricky because a lot of them are 126 HP, which is a little bit non-standard. Okay, let's have a look. We've got a 12U, so 4-row, 104 HP powered case. So these ones, I believe, are a wooden base with a really durable-looking kind of Tolex-y style covering. Really great fittings and findings and butterfly catches everywhere. And they have a clever kind of hinged mechanism with a central ring to keep the modules apart from each other, which also supports them in a sort of, I don't know, 60 degree angle. Place your bets with the internal power supply.
Yep.
What do they say? There's 80 power headers in there. What do we got? What do we got? Power specs. Sort of, this is per case. 2 amps on the plus 12, 1.2 on the minus 12, 1.5 amp. 1.5 amps on the plus 5? That's insane. Anyway, nobody's going to use that.
Can I intercede and ask you a quick question?
Yes.
Have you ever had any modules that require 5 volts?
I potentially one. No, am I making that up? No, what I'm thinking of is on, I think it's on the micros use, you can give your plus and minus 12 more power by disabling the 5 volt.
Okay.
So I did that. So I think that's my only experience with the 5 volt
yes,
supply.
I've never had a single module that requires 5 volts, ever.
Yeah. The only time I considered it was dope for make a little USB power thing just to put lights or power a controller from. That's all I've thought of.
No, I've absolutely never had one.
That seems like a waste. 1.5 amps on the plus 5. Anyway, place your bets on the price of this one. I'll get you a good picture to show you that doesn't show the price, so there's no spoilers. Here we go. That's
so that
it.
Case.
Unfolded, that's it, with the all the gubbins. External power bricks, though.
In pounds or dollars? Or
this
euros.
Is in euros, so close enough to pounds.
600 euros.
No.
Okay. 800 euros. 1,000 euros. 1,200 euros.
1,329.
How many how many HP?
Oh, wait, no. 1,400 including VAT. 104 by 12U.
So that's 4 rows of 104.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money.
It's a
but
really lot of money.
To be fair, absolutely no complaints about them from what I've seen on the forums and everything.
For 1,400 euros,
yeah.
It'd be really good.
Yeah, so then there's the powered Eurorack one. So actually, something looking pretty moth-like, to be honest. So a studio one that is 4 rows and a 1U, like an IntelliGel style, with power 817. Looks fairly neat. Ooh, they have a DIY one now. What's this? DIY.
I mean, I've always thought that if I was ever to sell
the
Moth case for whatever reason, I would get a substantial amount of money for it.
Probably. I mean, it absolutely looks the part.
I had the foolish idea at one stage of actually making more of them and seeing if I could sell them, but there's so many people who have tried that game. You really got to be set up properly for that.
Mm-hmm.
I had a vision of getting one of these tiny little CNCs where you can engrave and actually
make a little logo.
The Rack Addicts logo on the side of it.
That'd be cool, though.
Yeah, I'm too lazy for any of this.
Right, we've ranted about Eurorack cases for a bit of a time. We have another segment that we sometimes have, or most of the time we've got this one, and it's great fun. And if you like strange spatial things, then Luke has something for you in Luke's Spacey Bit. We need to get Luke into the studio to hear his delicious voice.
I have
with our faces
said exactly that to him via the WhatsApp.
Yep.
Only today.
We've got the SM7Bs ready, Luke. Get ye hence. This'll just be a pre-record, but I hope you enjoy.
Hello, and welcome back to our segment. Space tourism is the hot new industry that's finally getting off the ground, so to speak, in 2021. We've heard the stories of mind-boggling sums of money changing hands for seats on experimental craft like the New Shepard rocket developed by Blue Origin, but now the market is growing as infrastructure development increases in other areas. Jeff Bezos and brother Mark will join an as-yet-unnamed successful bidder who paid $28 million to partake in the first crewed flight of the new craft, which is aiming to launch on the 20th of July. The price of the third seat on this mission is to be donated to Blue Origin's charity Club for the Future, which is aiming to encourage and inspire young people to get into STEM through a series of activities that largely involve launching new Shepard missions. Humorously, a petition has emerged online demanding that Bezos and co. should not be allowed to return to Earth once they leave on their planned mission. While this is borderline unenforceable, the point is to draw attention to the gross inequality between billionaires and the ordinary workers of our society. It has over 120,000 signatures at the time of recording. The statement on change.org is very much worth a read. Others in the commercial sphere are aiming to be the next into space. Virgin Galactic has been granted the approval necessary for launching customers into space by the FAA. The Federal Aviation Administration controls and monitors companies that fly commercially. You may have heard of them keeping a close eye on SpaceX when their starships had the, well, penchant for exploding. Seats on the future plane Galactic are estimated to cost around $250,000 or more and buy you a trip to the edge of the Kármán line some 300,000 feet above the surface of the Earth. Virgin Galactic is an air launch vehicle which makes the first part of its journey on a dual fuselage airplane before separating at 50,000 feet and igniting the rocket motor built into the spaceplane. Firing a rocket at this altitude and speed means that the process is significantly more fuel efficient for the size and shape of the craft than it would be at sea level. Less fuel is needed to reach space, and the result is a very small craft that needs only one size of engine bell for its journey, as it begins firing only where the atmosphere is very thin already. The thickest part of the atmosphere, up to 50,000 feet, is handled by the jet engines of the air launch vehicle. After ascending on the rocket motor to the edge of space, the plane flips, allows its passengers to view the deep dark and outline of the world below, before braking and gliding down through the atmosphere to land. If that sounds expensive and stomach-churning, then fear not. A Floridian transport company called Space Perspective is charging $125,000 for stratospheric balloon rides. Customers will experience a 6-hour trip on a balloon vehicle that will take them up to 100,000 feet above sea level and return over the course of 6 hours. Unlike the vomit-inducing backflip experience that the Virgin Galactic is selling, Space Perspective offer a more sedate affair, including reclining chairs, panoramic windows, a bar, goddamn, and other amenities like a bathroom. This is due to the fact that changes in gravity aboard the balloon craft will be very subtle and carried out over a long period of time during the upward journey. Where a rocket ship will press you into the seat as it's lofted upwards by a controlled explosion, a balloon-powered craft would exert no such violent forces on its passengers, allowing them to move more freely around a much more luxuriously spaced cabin. Space tourism, therefore, is shaping up to be an industry of the now, less so one of the distant future. Whether this is a good thing or not remains to be seen. There is much debate over whether or not private funds behind these initiatives could be better spent on more urgent concerns, and the arguments are sound. My hope is only that as the industry and practice develops, the cost of such indulgence drops and may pave the way for increased scientific understanding of the effects of space travel on the human body, as well as further developments in spaceflight technology for the good of all. That's it for today. Join us again next time for more space news and discussions. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
And thank you as always, Luke. You won't escape us forever. We'll have you here in person. We can talk video games and whiskey and then space and music, most likely, as well. That rounds us off. We're in the final segment, everybody. The miscellaneous multimedia recommendation. Pete, fire away. Let me scrabble around on the internet for things that I've been doing recently. What do you have?
This is a new one to me. On YouTube, there is a myriad of people giving production advice, equipment advice, run-throughs on various bits and pieces, how to do certain things, you know, the sort of type of thing I'm talking about. Some are better than others. Some are not that good. Some are unintelligible.
Come across those, yeah.
And don't really help at all. But one I have come across recently, in the last week, I thought was quite useful. It grabbed my attention on the particular topic and led me to listen to some more. Then the YouTube channel is called Underdog Electronic Music School. And it's a gentleman who hails from Belgium, and he tackles various different production techniques using in-the-box equipment, but they're all useful if you are producing EDM. So I don't think it necessarily matters that you're using maybe plugins and soft synths, or maybe your initial recordings are from hardware, but his type of techniques are the sort of things that you're going to be doing in when you get deeper into producing a track and trying to finish it. But he takes one particular subject and quite tightly focuses on it, and he seems to be able to project the relevant information quite succinctly, and I found it quite useful. It's very Ableton Live orientated, so I'm not able to grasp everything and necessarily translate it, but because he's talking about fundamental stuff, it does cross over.
Oh yeah, nice.
The actual detail functionality obviously is very
depends on the workflow
Ableton
sometimes.
Focused.
Yeah.
And some of the function and facilities in Ableton don't necessarily exist or exist in the same way within other doors.
Yeah.
But I still feel there's a lot to be gleaned from this particular gentleman. I did a quite nice one on developing bass melodies, and there was a good one on polyrhythms, because he actually explains without going into too much theoretical, but just enough so that you can actually grasp what he's saying. As I say, there's quite a few tutorial videos, and I've watched loads of them and you don't always come away with anything new or useful, but this one's particularly good. So that's my recommendation for this week, the YouTube channel Underdog Electronic Music School.
Lovely stuff. While I was in the Lake District, I left my Lyra 8 with Telmo because I knew it'd drag something great out of it. So I'm actually going to recommend him as my miscellaneous multimedia recommendation this week. So if you go onto the YouTubes and you go onto Telmo Terremoto Music, T-E-L-M-O, and then a space, T-E-R-R-E-M-O-T-O, Music, Telmo Terremoto Music. I think it's his latest video. Guitarist tries analog synthesizer Soma Lyra 8. And it's great because he's never used the thing before. And I keep telling people that if you have, you have no real advantage in getting music out of the thing. And it sounds so Lyra. It's brilliant. Really good stuff. Just a little 3-minute one. There's some melody. There's some nice stuff. There's some ambience. And then there's some dirty stuff too. I think it's going into his Apollo Twin Universal Audio. He's using some plugins there. So he's got the RMX-16 for a bit of verb, some EQ. And I think he had tapes in for some wibbly-wobbly stuff as well, the Ampex one. Great video. Go and have a look. Well, ladles and jelly spoons, thank you for listening, as always, to Rack Addicts After Hours. We do hope you tune in once more and you have an excellent day. Farewell!